Airlines need help. Parents and teachers need help. Small businesses need help. Is there anybody out there? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, September 23rd, and it's good to have you with us. We begin today with airlines. Their CEOs and union leaders are begging Congress for an extension to the $25 billion industry bailout that was part of the CARES Act. Travel demand isn't returning fast enough, and now the industry is warning of a massive wave of layoffs if lawmakers don't extend funding before October 1st. But Congress is fighting and preoccupied. So where does that leave the airlines and their employees? Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
According to the trade group Airlines for America, passenger volume is off about 65% from a year ago, and airlines are collectively burning through $5 billion each month. CEO Nick Calio says airlines are asking for 6 more months of federal help.
Because hopefully by then we will be over the hump, and we will start to have a pickup in travel by next spring.
The conditions of the previous bailout protected workers until October 1st. Calio warns that up to 100,000 airline employees could soon join the ranks of the unemployed. And Robert W. Mann, a former airline executive and industry consultant, says a second bailout would help the U.S. economy recover faster when the pandemic wanes.
If the industry were to fall into disrepair, if it were to fall into destructive restructuring during the pandemic, the question would be, what would you have around to, you know, help you around on the other side?
When exactly we get to the other side of the pandemic, that's still murky. And Veronique Desrougiers at George Mason University says another $25 billion is not going to solve the problem.
This is just postponing the inevitable. As long as the demand doesn't go back up, this is just basically a Band-Aid patch.
She says bankruptcy would be the best option. Airlines have shown that they can emerge from restructuring healthier. And she says that means troubled airlines don't pose a major risk to the economy at large. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Whoo boy, this ongoing investigation by BuzzFeed and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which found trillions of dollars worth of money laundering and financial crimes happening because basically on millions of occasions, banks and other financial institutions suspected something fishy was going on with financial transactions, notified the government, and then allowed them to proceed, which seems like the kind of thing the government should be able to stop. We asked Marketplace's Sabri Benisher to look a little deeper.
The government actually has lots of power to stop money laundering.
Under the USA Patriot Act, there's Section 311, Trading with the Enemy Act. OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control within the Treasury.
You get the idea. That is Jim Richards, by the way. He's founder of RegTech Consulting and used to manage financial crimes risk at Wells Fargo. The issue, he and other experts say, is the sheer volume of suspicious transactions.
In the U.S., last year, about 2.7 million suspicious activity reports were filed, which is about 10,000 every business day.
Suspicious activity reports, or SARs, are notices financial institutions are required to give to the government anytime they see something fishy. But the bar for what is fishy is low, says Dan Newcomb, counsel at law firm Sherman & Sterling. And there are just so many reports.
It is very rare that there's a follow-up on a SAR by the government. And I attribute that to their lack of investigative resources.
The government may indeed not be adequately resourced, says Jarrett Seberg, policy analyst at Cohen Washington Research Group. But he warns against ceding enforcement power to banks.
Do we really want banks cutting people and companies off from the financial system based on a suspicion without orders from law enforcement?
However one answers that question, one thing is sure, Seberg says, banks and their regulators are about to get a lot of political scrutiny ahead of an election. In New York, I'm Sabri Benisher for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, once again, Federal Reserve officials said that without more fiscal relief from Congress, the economy will continue to decline. Once again, investors got briefly concerned. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. now to the presidential election already in progress. Campaigns and outside groups are pouring money into Florida, where it's expected to be close, including spending to help Floridians who have been incarcerated regain their right to vote. Florida voters said yes, but the state's Republican lawmakers and governor said no, not unless those people pay off fines and fees. The ACLU sued over that tweak. A federal court upheld the rule, and legal challenges to the rule might not come in time for Election Day. So a coalition of activist groups is just paying off people's fines for them. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Billionaire Michael Bloomberg has raised at least $16 million to help pay fines and fees in Florida. Other celebrities, including LeBron James, have their own efforts. Shannon Portillo is a political science professor at the University of Kansas.
What we've seen is a big push in Florida because they have the largest number of disenfranchised voters.
These contributions, she says, are great for those who want to vote but couldn't afford to otherwise.
This does demonstrate how much money is affecting politics in our country.
Florida isn't the only state where this is happening. Mitchell Brown is with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice in North Carolina. He was part of a successful effort there to unlink payment of fines and fees from voting rights.
Many states across the country, you know, in order to have your right to vote restored, you have to pay all your fines, fees, and restitution because the state considers that a part of your sentence.
In 2019, at least 8 states explicitly said formerly incarcerated people can't vote unless they pay, according to the Campaign Legal Center, which is fighting against the Florida restrictions. Portillo at the University of Kansas says legal fights over these restrictions will continue past the election.
But ultimately, people's right to vote shouldn't hinge on the charitable decisions of the wealthy.
But in Florida, this year, for thousands of formerly incarcerated people, it does. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
As families endure the new school year, remotely or in person, lots of parents are questioning whether the traditional school system is safe for their kids during the pandemic and whether it's actually working for their kids in the long run. Emma Green is a staff writer for The Atlantic who recently wrote about parents who are pivoting to homeschooling. Welcome, Emma.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So before the pandemic, let's get a little level set. How many students were homeschooled officially in the United States?
So we're looking at roughly 3% of the American population. And often the scholars who look at the homeschool world divide it up into these two camps of people who are religious, Christian mostly, and people who are kind of hippies. But as we've seen with the pandemic, that is expanding rapidly.
And do we have any indication? Are there any numbers about how many parents are either considering or shifting to homeschooling now?
You know, we don't have that data yet. And I think the reason is that we are still very much in the thick of it with trying to get a handle on what's happening educationally around the country. But I can tell you anecdotally from having made a bunch of calls to parents who are trying it and also to homeschoolers who have been getting inquiries, there's just a flood of interest from parents of all kinds saying, I don't think this is the way for us. I don't think I can stand the uncertainty of not knowing whether my kid is going to be home with us after going to in-person school if there's an outbreak. So we see from some of these anecdotal pieces of evidence that there are a lot of families who otherwise would never have considered homeschooling who are now trying it.
There's been a lot of conversation about the infrastructure that is necessary to pull this off. Like a lot of students just don't have internet access at home. And so we should clarify that this is not an option for every student. And I wonder what other infrastructure exists. What do you need if you suddenly want to start homeschooling?
So one thing I heard a lot from the homeschool families that I talked to who had been homeschooling prior to COVID-19 was a kind of resistance to the narrative that homeschooling requires a lot of money or a lot of resources. Many of them talked about your public library card being your ultimate ticket to homeschooling. But I think you're absolutely right to point out that there are built-in inequities here. For kids whose parents work full-time or who are sort of balancing work out of the house during the COVID pandemic, it's just impossible to expect those parents to simultaneously homeschool their kids. It's also impossible to expect those parents to watch over their kids' shoulders as they do Zoom school and distance school for a traditional schooling system. So I think the takeaway here is that inequities are affecting kids on both sides of the ticker, those who are exiting the traditional schooling system and those who are staying in.
As you do your reporting, how much do you think we're going to continue to see, though, the landscape of schooling overall change?
Oh, I think that this is just an extraordinary moment. And I think that because there's no end in sight for the pandemic, it's really not clear that any point during the 2020-2021 school year, there's going to be a reprieve or a return to normal. And what I'm interested in as a reporter is seeing over the course of this year into the next year and the year after that, whether the pandemic represents an inflection point for a whole uptick in a new suite of parents and families who are homeschooling who probably would not have if they never had experienced the pandemic.
Emma Green is a staff writer for The Atlantic. Thanks so much for the time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Coming up,
I can't dribble a basketball or run track.
She can, however, climb. But first, let's do the numbers. It's the down music. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 525 points, 1.9%, to finish at 26,763. The NASDAQ fell 330 points, 3%, to end at 10,632. And the S&P 500 was off 78 points, 2.3%, to land at 3236. Andy Uhler talked about airline woes thanks to the pandemic. One silver lining for airlines has been the cost of jet fuel. According to the International Air Transport Association, as of last week, it was down 3% compared to a month earlier and almost 49% compared to a year ago. That's something. Bonds fell, but the yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 0.67%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. More on remote schooling, this time technology and student privacy. This is a question I get a lot. And there are laws designed to protect student information and privacy. One is FERPA, not a stuffed animal, a federal law called the Family Educational Rights and Protection Act. There's the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA. But school, as you just heard, is changing fast. So we've got Amelia Vance of the nonprofit Future of Privacy Forum on the line. I asked her, with kids using all these new education tools, what does that mean for privacy?
Absolutely. So this is actually a pretty regulated area. Fortunately, we have well over 100 laws passed just in the past 6 years in 41 states on student privacy. But you run into problems because, of course, laws are only as good as their implementation. And oftentimes, teachers and schools may not even know that a law exists, or because we're in an emergency situation, may choose to overlook the law in favor of, you know, making sure that kids are getting educated right now. So it can be really challenging when it comes to privacy.
So we're seeing companies have products that are being used in all kinds of ways that they maybe didn't expect, right? Like Zoom did not expect itself to necessarily become a tele-schooling tool.
What I'm still worried about is companies like Zoom that do not have an education part of their product, because one big hole in those student privacy laws is that they don't cover non-education companies, even when those companies are being used in schools. And so when, you know, a foreign language teacher decides that, you know, kids better learn foreign languages by using an app that teaches them Italian or French, that app is for consumers generally. It's not covered under the student privacy laws. Certainly the teacher and the school is still subject to FERPA, but that company doesn't have any obligations, even if they are heavily marketing to schools.
Oh, that is a big deal. So if a school says, all right, I'm going to start using this consumer app because it's super useful and it has served me a bunch of ads on Instagram saying it's great for school, what is the difference? Like, how does a company or a product become specifically ed tech versus general consumer?
So they can opt into it. So you have something like G Suite for Education, which was, you know, created, is marketed for schools, has a special school terms of service, and is understood to be subject to, you know, those hundreds of laws I mentioned. But you run into this weird fairness issue, and where, of course, you know, that foreign language app has no idea that that teacher has had their students sign up to the app. And so there's an open question about at what point do you cross a threshold that that company should be held liable for higher protections for children or student data when they may or may not know that children or students are using it.
What could happen, especially as you have this kind of like flood of new apps and smaller companies and you know, potentially commercial applications? Like, what do you worry about with respect to the data collection around kids?
One of the number one concerns that I often hear from parents is around, understandably, commercialization. So, you know, the creation perhaps of an advertising profile of their child. However, we see a little less of that. As I said, many laws cover that. And where I get really worried is where there's, you know, weak security and there might be data breaches. And these aren't sort of the data breaches that we often see reported where it's, you know, identity theft or something like that, though that's possible. Most schools, though, don't have social security numbers. Instead, we see the possibility of sensitive information about someone, things like disciplinary history, health issues, special education status. And we know from research that the number one thing that kids care about when it comes to privacy really is that interpersonal privacy, you know, keeping their business.
Amelia Vance is Director of Youth and Education Privacy at the nonprofit Future of Privacy Forum. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks again for having me.
The federal government is cracking down on alleged fraud in the Paycheck Protection Program, those loans for businesses that were supposed to help them stay open during the pandemic, but were distributed unevenly at best. The Justice Department recently filed nearly 60 charges involving attempts to bilk over $175 million out of the program. Meanwhile, legitimate borrowers are working to get their loans forgiven. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more.
Justice Department lawyers say the defendants spent PPP money on home renovations, trips to Vegas, even a Lamborghini. Randy George is the co-owner of Red Hen Baking Company and Cafe in Vermont. He says it's discouraging to hear stories like that, but it isn't surprising.
I think that the way that it was carried out allowed for a lot of abuse.
The program rolled out quickly. George says that helped businesses like his. He took out a PPP loan back in April because he needed the money fast.
It was like, we take this money or we face potential closure. I don't know what we would have done.
When designing relief programs, governments face difficult choices, says Catherine Judge, a professor at Columbia Law School. If a program has a rigorous application process, a business might make one mistake and not qualify for aid. Judge says the government decided to make PPP relatively easy.
And as a result, we might have a little bit of fraud, but the more important aim is to get a lot of money into the hands of a lot of small businesses in a very short window of time. And they really succeeded in that regard.
Now, the government's dilemma is whether to make it easy to get a PPP loan forgiven. One idea, automatically forgiving loans under a certain amount, say $150,000. Robert James II at Carver State Bank in Georgia says that would help the bank avoid having to collect on risky loans.
If the government makes it onerous and difficult for customers to get the loans forgiven, then we're going to really have a very unstable, potentially harmful asset on our books.
James says right now, the forgiveness process is rigorous. Borrowers have to come up with documents proving they spent the money on payroll, rent, and other approved expenses. But James says he knows his customers.
We're very confident our customers did what they said they were going to do with the money, and so we just don't want to have to burden them further.
James says he's advised his customers to hold off on applying for forgiveness until Congress weighs in. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Rock climbing, the sport, was supposed to make its Olympic debut in Tokyo this summer. Neither of those things happened. But the reinvigorated Black Lives Matter movement has renewed calls for the outdoor industry, and climbing in particular, to become more inclusive. That has long been a goal for Coach Emily Taylor. The next subject of our series, My Economy.
I'm Emily Taylor, and I am the owner of Tailored Fit Solutions, and I'm also the founder of Brown Girls Climbing, which is a Black and brown all-girls rock climbing team in the Bay Area. I do multiple things under being a professional coach and working with different populations here, but primarily my focus is on getting Black and brown and marginalized folks in the outdoor environment and in rock climbing. People get into climbing for two reasons, either for love or for grief, and sometimes for both. And I got into climbing for grief. I went on an Outward Bound trip the summer after my father had died, and he was my only parent. He was my single parent. And at that point, I was a band geek, and I can't dribble a basketball or run track. And so this is the first time I'm actually athletic in my body and I can feel my body come alive. When I got back from Outward Bound school, I found the local climbing gym, which was right on the Charlotte border where I went to school. And it was owned by a Black guy. And I didn't know that there wasn't a different world until I moved from that world into recognizing that the climbing industry is all, pretty much all white. There was this moment where I was running all the competitions in the Southeast for USA Climbing. And I had sat down to take a break next to my partner. And this 7-year-old energetic Black boy came and sat in my lap. And my partner looked at me going, "Who is this kid?" And I was just like, "I don't know who this kid is." And before he turned around and he goes, "Oh, I thought you were my mama." And that was the moment that struck me for this kid to feel so comfortable in sitting in my lap because there was only two Black women in this space was the moment that I realized that was the change that needed to happen. I care about what rock climbing can do for other people and can do for our bodies, and the therapeutic value of healing and the process of movement. My vision is to be this bridge to close the gap for the next generation.
That was Emily Taylor in good old Oakland, California. Tell us about your economy at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out, I mentioned earlier that the Federal Reserve is asking for more relief from Congress to help the economy and the struggling people and small businesses that make up the economy.
Also today, the Business Roundtable, the group of influential CEOs of major companies, released a survey that reiterated that more federal aid and getting the virus under control are necessary to prevent long-term economic damage. Any old time now, folks. All right, we got to go. Our amazing media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, J.C. Bold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. And I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.